Support for WAER Original Podcasts comes from California Closets of Syracuse, located in DeWitt. California Closets can help you get your entire home organized with custom-designed storage solutions for the home office, kitchen pantry, closets, and more. Online at californiaclosets.com.
The beginning of November has an odd coincidence. On the one hand, it is typically the climax of the political season, with national, state, and local elections that will decide the shape of the country. On the other hand, it is also the epicenter of America's sporting calendar. The World Series is often entering its final games. NFL and NCAA football teams are entering the make-or-break period of their seasons. The NBA has its first tip-offs. Virtually every major sports league has some stake in November. Of course, sports and politics are not only related through a coincidence of the calendar. Whether it is NASCAR fans chanting "Let's go, Brandon" as a slur against the president, or NFL players taking a knee to protest police brutality against citizens of color, politics is everywhere in sports. And this is nothing new. I'm Kendall Phillips, and on this episode of Pop Life, we'll explore the complex interconnections of sports, politics, and popular culture. Here to help us in our efforts is Dr. Abraham Kahn. Dr. Kahn is a professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Arkansas. He specializes in popular culture, sports, and racial politics. He is the author of numerous academic essays and the book Curt Flood in the Media, Baseball, Race, and the Demise of the Activist Athlete. Abe, welcome to Pop Life.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
No, thrilled to have you. So thinking about your work, you know, often I hear now people sort of grumble, I wish politics would get out of sports. Like, I don't want politics in my sports. Mm. And yet it does seem like the history of sports is full of politics. Can you talk to us a little about this kind of long-standing relationship between sports and politics and popular culture?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting about that is that if you had, I don't know, if I was talking to you 10 or 12 years ago, you actually might have posed the question in the reverse. In other words, you would have heard lots of people saying, God, I wish there was some politics in my sports. Athletes have become completely apolitical. What happened to this grand tradition of athletes speaking truth to power? You know, there certainly is a long history, but there was also a period of decline, which is a point that I tried to make in my book about Curt Flood. But, you know, the origin of athletes engaging in politics, it's difficult to really sort of place the origin. You could probably start with Jack Johnson winning the world heavyweight title in 1908, although he wasn't much of an activist, but he was certainly a political flashpoint, especially around race politics in the U.S. Then there was Jesse Owens, who won 4 gold medals right in front of Hitler's eyes in 1936. There was Jackie Robinson breaking baseball's color line in 1947, which is a fascinating political moment. And I hope we get a quick chance to talk about actually Jackie Robinson in 1949. That was the year that he won the National League MVP, but it was also the year that he broke his 2 years of silence that he had promised to Branch Rickey prior mm-hmm. to being signed to the Dodgers. And then, of course, there were the events of the mid to late 1960s. And there was, you know, it's a time when Muhammad Ali refused to go to Vietnam and was both loud and poetic in his refusal to go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. There was John Carlos and Tommy Smith raising their fists at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, which my guess is that most of the listeners have seen that photograph, and I would at least argue that it's among the most famous photographs in American history, not just the history of sports. There was, you know, the way that Curt Flood challenged baseball in 1970. The Kareem Abdul-Jabbar became an activist in this era. Not long after, I think it was 1972 or 1973. I'm forgetting my dates here, but Billie Jean King participated in the Battle of the Sexes against Bobby Riggs at the Houston Astrodome. And that certainly was a spectacular moment for gender politics in the U.S. But, you know, all along the way, you know, and I highlight black athletes and I highlight female athletes in particular because of the way that the politics-sports relationship has typically been understood through the problem of identity and inclusion and national belonging. There have been, I think, a variety of different ways to track the way that that different athletes have tried to make the argument for inclusion or national belonging. Or, you know, I mean, you know, Ali was an internationalist who in many ways brought post-colonial discourses into the politics of sport. Someone like Jackie Robinson, he broke baseball's color line just after World War II, and so was sort of deeply involved in the Cold War era. And so his argument was much different than Muhammad Ali's or Carlos and Smith's were. And then there was sort of a period of 40-year decline, and there are a bunch of reasons why, you know, there are a number of reasons that we can point to account for that decline. But I think the one that's most frequently pointed to by most media commentators is the rise in athlete salaries. The fact that this is a moment in American history around 1975 when athletes really started to get rich, which made them somewhat reluctant or averse to political controversy, especially in the way that political controversy might interfere with endorsement contracts. And then in 2012, after Trayvon Martin was murdered in Florida, the LeBron James and Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade and the rest of the Miami Heat posed in hoodies in order to draw attention to the fact that Martin was killed in an unjust fashion. And that sort of set off a chain of events, I think. There were a few athletes here and there between, let's say, 1972, 1973, and 2012, but they were kind of few and far between. They tended to be on an island. I'm thinking of Carlos Delgado, the baseball player who refused to sort of perform the national anthem in a ceremonial fashion, or Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, who was a basketball player for the Denver Nuggets. And he also, instead of standing for the anthem, he posed in Muslim prayer to sort of oppose American imperialism. But after 2012, you got Colin Kaepernick, you got the WNBA really becoming kind of a cauldron for what contemporary sports activism would look like. And then, in my mind, the two most significant events were when the University of Missouri football team refused to play, or they announced that they would refuse to play until the university had made some administrative changes and done some things to recruit and retain Black students and faculty. And then when the Milwaukee Bucks led an entire wave all across sports of athletes just they walked off the job because they didn't want to play under conditions that were defined by extreme and highly visible instances of anti-Black violence. So, I mean, the history is there, and I'm happy to talk about any one of those moments, but certainly it's been sort of from the beginning of the 20th century, sort of an ebb and flow of athletes entering politics, exiting politics, and making all sorts of different demands, both in the United States and abroad, for racial justice, gender justice, and kind of anti-colonial justice.
No, that's an incredibly valuable overview. So thank you for that history lesson. I think we got a lot of it in a nutshell, but I want to kind of roll back and sort of look at some of those punctuation points. And so it seems like, and even from your recounting here, it seems that many of those early kind of political athlete figures were political largely just by their embodied presence. So Jack Johnson as the first, African-American Black man to win the heavyweight championship, his physical presence creates politics. Same with Jesse Owens at the Olympics.
Right.
It is his embodied presence. And is it that 1949 moment with Jackie Robinson deciding now to speak out? Is that one of those punctuation points where it's not just the athlete physically being there, being a kind of political statement, but now the athlete actively kind of promoting a political agenda or speaking back to relations of power?
Yeah, in many ways, Jackie Robinson helps to crystallize a variety of different forms of being an activist athlete. Because like you said, there was the embodied presence of Jack Johnson. I think that Jesse Owens was probably a bit more self-aware of what his accomplishments meant in a broader sort of global political context than he's often given credit for. But Jackie Robinson, right? I mean, Jackie Robinson's kind of definitive biographer is a man named Jules Tygiel, who passed away a couple of years ago. But Tygiel wrote a book in the early 80s called Baseball's Great Experiment. And since that book, really, the way that Jackie Robinson integrating Major League Baseball has been described is as a kind of project, right? A very sort of carefully curated, staged project. And it was not just Jackie Robinson's project. It was a collaboration between Jackie Robinson and Branch Rickey in order to change the face of the national pastime. And so Jackie Robinson certainly, what's the best way to put it? Jackie Robinson's embodied presence did in fact become politicized. But then there was also the fact that Robinson was well aware of how he fit into emerging forms of black politics in the 1940s, in the immediate post-war era. And so, you know, Branch Rickey sort of famously told Robinson that in order for the project to work, he was going to have to stay silent for 2 years and essentially play his way into acceptance, right? Use the spectacle of black excellence to make the case undeniable for black athletes in Major League Baseball. And so he did that, but the moment in which he chose to break his silence was sort of a curious one, because this is when the Red Scare it's in sort of full flower, and the House Un-American Activities Committee is interrogating pretty much anyone they can get their hands on. And in 1949, Paul Robeson, the singer, actor, ex-football player, and of course, well-known communist, was at a peace conference in Paris, and someone in the press quoted him as saying, and the reason I put it that way is because there's differing accounts as to whether or not this actually happened. But he was quoted in the press as having said that, no, quote unquote, no American Negro worth his salt would fight in a war against the Soviet Union were one to come to pass. And the House Un-American Activities Committee, of course, saw this as an opportunity to connect the emerging civil rights movement in the late 1940s to communism, which, you know, of course, a number of civil rights leaders and civil rights activists in the late 1940s were petrified of that connection. And so CUAC invited Jackie Robinson to come and kind of disavow Robeson's claim. And he did. And he did it in a kind of, in an almost a surprisingly vicious fashion. And of course the New York Times ran with it. Congress ran with it. Everybody loved the fact that, that Robinson's claim to, desegregation, was grounded in an explicit form of anti-communism. And so what's interesting about Jackie Robinson, for me, I think the fact that this is also a moment where really sort of left-wing radical politics get written out of the civil rights movement. But it's also interesting, I think, to pay attention to that moment with Jackie Robinson, because he wasn't simply an embodied presence. He was making a case. He had an affirmative argument that he made in front of Congress for racial integration. And of course, it had everything to do with the early Cold War politics of the time.
So does that open the door for those more, vocal activist athletes who will become increasingly prominent throughout the 60s? And obviously, the 60s is a very different time than the 50s.
Right.
But is that, you know, is Robinson kind of stepping out and becoming a kind of political agent, a very, you know, very articulate political agent, really speaking an agenda out into the world? Is that part of what opens the door for later folks who are going to be a little more challenging to the American way and American government?
I think that that's one way of looking at it. And certainly the fact that, you know, Jackie Robinson never stopped being political. By the time I think Robinson retired in 1955, 1956, something like that. And then he started writing columns. In black newspapers, the columns that I reviewed appeared in the New York Amsterdam News, and they appeared all throughout the 1960s. And so you can view Jackie Robinson as kind of the entry point into black athletes being more explicitly political. But it was also, I think, in many ways, dissatisfaction with a Jackie Robinson-style politics that helped to generate, for example, the civil rights movement's turn to black power in the late 1960s. There was also the formation of the Black Panthers in the Bay Area in California in 1966, I think. And the idea was that black athletes had, at this point, had become sort of not fully integrated, but had started to integrate institutions, not just professional athletic organizations like Major League Baseball, the National Football League, but also universities. And just as the New Left kind of grows out of student movements, I think that the way that black athletes had started to radicalize in the late 1960s was kind of an outgrowth. It's two things. One is their direct experience, right? Yeah. They are the ones integrating campuses, and they are also mistreated on those integrated campuses. And so John Carlos and Tommy Smith were both athletes for San Jose State University, which at the time was an almost exclusively white university, except for the very small handful of athletes that were there. And they experienced ostracism and mistreatment and everything else, right? So they're feeling it. But also, this is the Bay Area of California in 1967, 1968. Right. The Panthers are formed in the Bay Area, and there's a lot of black radicalism going around. They're experiencing a form of mistreatment, and then they're connecting that to a kind of ambient discourse of emerging black power. And so there's sort of a time, I think this is a moment where their courage and their boldness is cultivated by cultures of activism that are emerging around them. And I also think that it's kind of a direct rejection of the African American politics that was expressed by Jackie Robinson, where integration was the end game. And right. for folks like Carlos and Smith and Muhammad Ali, integration didn't seem to be all it was cracked up to be. And so as the language of civil rights moves from integration to a broader and more international sense of social justice, enter, right, people like John Carlos, Tommy Smith, and Muhammad Ali, who are speaking, I think, a much more radical language than was once embodied by Jackie Robinson. Meanwhile, he's still speaking the integration narrative.
Sure.
In the 1960s. And by the time you get to the late 1960s, Jackie Robinson is seen as increasingly out of touch.
So it's kind of that respectability politics people talk about
as
part of early civil rights.
Absolutely.
So in that rejection of respectability politics, it seems to me, and again, you're the expert here, but Muhammad Ali seems to be the person who is both very radical, has a very, very different global agenda, and in some ways also is the person who pays a pretty heavy price for that political activism. Is that your read as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Muhammad Ali paid arguably the heaviest price of all. I don't know. I'm partial to Kurt Flood as we start as we start evaluating the price that was paid by a number of different athletes. But Muhammad Ali couldn't fight between the ages of 25 and 28, which is basically for every professional male athlete, the prime of their career. Right, it's the center cut of their career. And he essentially went into athletic exile as a heavyweight champion, as the most famous person on earth.
Sure.
Doesn't get to fight again until 1970. And, you know, he pretty much, he would get his title back.
Yes.
Right. But the cost in the meantime was pretty extraordinary. He was broke. Prize fighting is lucrative, but it's not lucrative enough to survive 3 years of unemployment. and certainly Ali also is an ideal example of the rejection of 1940s, 1950s style respectability politics. I mean, you know, the thing to me that makes Ali Ali's charisma was simply unmatched in American history. There are plenty of charismatic athletes in the present. Certainly LeBron James is one of them. Someone like Richard Sherman is incredibly charismatic, but none with the kind of really self-aware kind of artistry of of Muhammad Ali. I know that ESPN ran a documentary, I think, I don't know, I want to say very recently, but it feels very old now, called Ali Rap. And the argument essentially is that hip hop music, rap music, is an outgrowth of the way that Ali was able to kind of spin rhymes, right, drop rhymes on a global stage in the 1960s and 1970s. And so that charisma was pretty difficult to, right? No one really compares on the charisma scale when it comes to Muhammad Ali, which is quite different, right, than Jackie Robinson basically staying utterly silent for two years. But then there was also the sense of very deliberate black pride that Muhammad Ali expressed. I mean, Muhammad Ali said over and over again, he told everybody who would listen how beautiful he was.
Yes.
Which wasn't just kind of self-flattery, but it was, I think, a form of communicating to black folks around the world that the definitions of them that had been essentially dominant and offered by white society, white elites on a global scale, following the long history of transatlantic slavery, that definition was not something that they had to accept. And so, yeah, I mean, the way you put it, Ali as a rejection of respectability politics. I think there's a variety of ways to discover that formula, but I think that formula is right.
No, and certainly a redefinition of respectability that is not told in terms of the kind of dominant white culture. Now, Ali, clearly, I think, still one of the most famous sports figures in history. I think Carlos and Smith, Jackie Robinson, these are names, but as the author of the book on Curt Flood. Curt Flood is one of those figures that is not, doesn't seem to me at least, talked about in pop culture in the same voice as these other folks. So for listeners who don't know about Curt Flood or his role in activist athletics, tell us a little bit about Curt Flood.
Yeah, Curt Flood was from Oakland. He grew up in Oakland, California, and he was a poor black kid from Oakland. And he played on some kind of some legendary youth teams. I think when he was a youngster, he played baseball with Vada Pinzone and I want to say Frank Robinson. I think it was Frank Robinson. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so they essentially played baseball in Oakland sandlots together in the 1950s. And in the late 1950s, he signed a contract to play with the Cincinnati Reds before he ever broke into the majors. The Cincinnati Reds traded his contract to the St. Louis Cardinals. And so he started in center field for the Cardinals throughout the 1960s. He won the 1964 World Series with the Cardinals. He won the 1967 World Series with the Cardinals. And then they lost to the Cardinals lost to the Detroit Tigers in the 1968 World Series. And he had made a life for himself, and Flood was a Renaissance man. I mean, he was a painter. He was sort of a man about town, right? He was handsome and dashing, and you know, always dressed to the nines, and would be seen at you know, all of the kind of society events in St. Louis in the 1960s. And by the time the 69 season, though, was a difficult one for the St. Louis Cardinals. They finished fourth, which was really disappointing, not only to the fans and to the team itself, but also to the team owner, Gussie Bush. And so Bush decided he wanted a clean house. And I guess the previous year, Flood had made kind of an indecorous demand for a salary raise, and Bush didn't like that and sort of regarded Flood as a troublemaker. And so at the end of the 1969 season, the Cardinals traded Flood from St. Louis to the Philadelphia Phillies. And he had built his entire life in St. Louis. He didn't want to go to Philadelphia. And he didn't want to go to Philadelphia for a couple of reasons. One, of course, was that St. Louis is anything, it was everything he had ever known. And the second is that Philadelphia had a reputation for having some of the most racist fans in baseball. And the other thing is that Philadelphia was kind of a, St. Louis was like a world-class sports organization. Think of the Dodgers now, maybe, sure. Or the Dallas Cowboys, right? That was the St. Louis Cardinals in the 1960s as far as a franchise was concerned. And the Philadelphia Phillies were sort of a, they weren't a small market team, but they were a low budget team. They were cheap. They were not very good. And nobody liked playing there, especially black baseball players. And so he said no. And so he wrote this letter to Major League Baseball, the commissioner, Bowie Kuhn, and he said, "I will not be bought and sold irrespective of my wishes. I am not a," he said, "I'm not a piece of property to be bought or sold irrespective of my wishes." And then he filed suit in federal court asking to be what we now call a free agent. There was no such thing as free agency in, at least not in Major League Baseball. The different North American major sports had a very sort of minor versions, minor situations in which athletes could negotiate their right to play for a different team with a new contract. But in Major League Baseball, they had something called the reserve clause. And the idea was every time you signed a contract, you signed a contract that gave the club with which you signed your contract the exclusive rights to sign you the following year. So every contract was a one-year contract, and you could not negotiate wage increases. Your only choice when it came to negotiating wage increases was to just not play. Hmm. And so Kurt Flood filed a federal lawsuit, and he had two claims in his lawsuit. The first is that baseball was violating antitrust law in restricting his labor movement, that essentially was a collusive labor restriction. And the second was that baseball violated the 13th Amendment, which, of course, prohibited involuntary servitude in the U.S. right. And then he went on national TV in front of Howard Cosell, national TV in front of the country. Howard Cosell was the interviewer. Right. And Cosell asked him, he said, "Kurt, you're a man who makes $90,000 a year, which isn't exactly slave wages. What's your retort to that?" And his answer was, "A well-paid slave is nonetheless a slave."
Wow.
And this in many ways outraged the nation. It outraged the nation because baseball was supposed to be our great progressive institution. Baseball had given us Jackie Robinson,
right?
Baseball was the marker by which we understood racial progress in the United States. And Kurt Flood goes on TV and says, "Baseball is slavery," right? And so he filed this lawsuit and he lost. He lost in federal court in 1970. He appealed it to the Supreme Court. And he lost in the Supreme Court in 1972. Meanwhile, he is out of baseball, right? He's done. And he, his biographer, Brad Snyder, makes the case that Flood was probably becoming an alcoholic in the late 1960s. And then by the time he fled to Europe. He ran a bar in Mallorca showing baseball games to expats in Spain. In the early 1970s, and sort of fully descended into alcoholism, and he eventually returned to the United States on the State Department's dime. In fact, you can find the telegram that was sent to Henry Kissinger saying, "Hey, someone come get your boy."
Oh my!
Right? And he returned to the United States, returned to Oakland with nothing but his dog and his shirt on his back.
Wow!
And so his personal story ends in tragedy. But at the same time, the Major League Baseball Players Association, led at the time by a man named Marvin Miller, saw Flood's case as an opportunity. And so the Players Association backed him under certain conditions. And by 1975, Major League Baseball, because the Players Association had by this time become a union, Major League Baseball had instituted a system of free agency. And so the fact that, you know, someone like Bryce Harper, or Mike Trout, or Clayton Kershaw, you know, these are guys that have, you know, $300-400 million contracts, long-term contracts. Those contracts are possible because Kurt Flood had the guts to sue Major League Baseball in the early 1970s.
And sadly paid the price for it. So let's fast forward to today. So now we have relatively well-paid athletes who have a great deal of negotiating power to decide their conditions of labor, et cetera.
Right.
But we have also had, as you pointed out earlier, a variety of political situations, Trayvon Martin, certainly the murder of George Floyd and others, that have called athletes and athletic organizations into politics. Do you feel like the money has enabled them to be more politically active and vocal? Or is the money still kind of muting the response?
I think it's both, frankly. And so the term I think that best captures the way that the current moment of athlete activism is the idea of the platform. And of course, the platform is more broadly, I think, a term that is more frequently heard in public life, only because social media has given kind of everyone a platform, right? I got like 800 Twitter followers. That's my platform, right?
Right.
I think that social media, the first thing that social media did was it gave athletes the opportunity to speak around the press. So they didn't have to rely on ESPN. They didn't have to rely on nationally circulating or local newspapers to vet or filter their comments or to contextualize them in damaging or, you know, kind of softening ways. So that's the thing that happened, is that social media allowed athletes a kind of direct opportunity to communicate with fans and other observers. But the problem is, at least in my view, is that the audience that athletes now have is bigger than it's ever been because of the platform. But on the other hand, the scope of what can be said on the platform it's narrower,
sure,
right, than the size of the audience. So it seems to me that, you know, all of the money, not just in media and sports, right? Certainly athletes can take a hit from one endorser, right, and then cash in with another endorser, right? That wasn't even the case, like, when Tiger Woods got in trouble. It wasn't an activist moment, but, you know, when Tiger Woods was involved in that infidelity scandal in 2009, right, you know, all of his endorsements or all of his sponsors cut him loose. He got him back, but they cut him loose. Now, Tiger Woods was the world's first ever billion-dollar athlete, so he could take that hit without having to worry about it. But, you know, the money does, in fact, I think, give athletes the opportunity to be a bit more risky. But on the other hand, athletes have to be incredibly careful, because, right, there's no way one of the most iconic examples of an athlete using an activist profile to actually make money, right, is Colin Kaepernick. Now, Colin Kaepernick lost his job playing in the NFL. He was blacklisted by the National Football League. And in my view, the world is a better place if you let Colin Kaepernick play football. But Colin Kaepernick also was able to secure a contract with Nike, right? And so he's making Nike commercials. And he becomes this sort of global icon for the new activist athlete. The problem is that you none of this can be anti-corporate speech,
sure,
right? There's all of this political speech, but none of it is anti-corporate. So the platform is big, but what you can say on it is small.
Because ultimately, you still want to get out on the field on Sunday night or Monday night and play that game. And so that kind of more radical politics, particularly, I guess, in team sports, where it is much more corporately governed than, say, Ali back in the heyday of boxing, when, you know, the world champion was the world champion. You couldn't just immediately ignore them, whereas Colin Kaepernick kind of gets removed from the NFL, although clearly. So where do you see the future, if you can sort of look 10 years down the line? Do you think we're going to have increasingly activist athletes who are maybe taking up a wide range of causes, or do you think folks are going to be cautious about backlash from endorsers or backlash on social media and keep their messages a bit more muted?
I actually think that we've settled into a model for how this process works. Now, I don't know what the fate of that model will be as American politics change. Hopefully the fascists don't take over. But as American politics changes, I don't know what the fate of ultimately the model will be. But essentially the model we have now, and, you know, I want to clarify, because it's not simply right that athletes find it very difficult to tell an anti-capitalist or an anti-corporate story. It's also the way that whether it's the leagues or it's advertisers, or if it's media institutions themselves. In many ways, these are organizations that these are American institutions that get sort of one way to Howard Bryant, the ESPN journalist who wrote a terrific book called The Heritage. Howard Bryant calls this greenwashing. Some other folks call it woke washing. But the idea is that, you know, Kaepernick has this massive platform with Nike. But what does Nike get out of it? What Nike gets out of it is that we don't have to talk about the massive wage discrimination lawsuit that they settled, right? It was a gender-based wage discrimination lawsuit they settled. We don't talk about, sweatshop labor in Southeast Asia, where they make their sneakers and all their other sporting goods equipment and the like, right? And so that's what Nike gets out of it. There's a Georgetown philosophy professor named Olafemi Taiwo who talks about elite capture. And Taiwo talks about elite capture sort of in the context of social movements, and he says that throughout history there have been sort of some folks at the top of the social movement who direct the message to down below, right? So as the social movement evolves, you have leaders in the social movement who essentially try to get the grassroots to adapt the social movement's message into an elite message. But to me, the iconic or the platonic form of elite capture is when Jerry Jones decided he was the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. Yes. Jerry Jones is going to kneel with the Cowboys.
Yes.
In 2017, as the Cowboy athletes want to take a knee, right? And so I think the model we have now is one where athletes know what they can and can't say. They, right, there is a plenty of political outspokenness, but large corporate institutions have figured out how to kind of piggyback on that energy so that they don't get, right, they don't incur any financial risks. And so I think the model that we're in now is one where there's lots of activist speech, but it is a kind of activist speech that's endorsed either by the NCAA or the NFL or by, you know, international governing bodies, you know, whether it's FIFA or Formula One, right? You can do all sorts of stuff, right? But it's stuff that fits within the confines of corporate governance. And as long as it fits within the confines of corporate governance, then the athletic institutions, whether it's media, governing bodies themselves, teams, et cetera, they can all make money on it. I think that's the model that we're in now. I just don't know what direction that model is headed, given the way that global politics is changing.
Well, when that model changes, Abe, we will have you back on Pop Life. You've given us an incredibly rich history and a great lesson on kind of the to and fro of activism and politics and professional sports. Now that we enter our two-minute warning, Abe, as regular listeners know, we have a little game we play with our guests. We call it the Fast Five. So, Abe, I'm going to ask you five somewhat irreverent questions related to sports and ask you to make a tough either-or decision. If you're ready,
okay.
Abe, we'll begin with question number one. If you could sit in the booth with one famous sports broadcaster during a game, would you choose Bob Costas or Mike Tirico?
Bob Costas. That one's easy.
Good.
Yeah. Okay. Should I give my reason?
If you want to give a quick reason, sure, absolutely.
Okay. Bob Costas is a legend, and there is, and I forget who wrote the book, but there's a great expose about behind the scenes at ESPN. It turns out that Mike Tirico might be a little bit of a creep. So
they are both Syracuse alums, I want to point out. But anyway, I'm sure they're both lovely.
Okay.
Question number two for you, Abe, before you get me fired from my university. Who was, for you, the greatest Chicago Bear of all time? Would it be Gale Sayers or Walter Payton?
Oh, I never saw Gale Sayers play. I grew up watching Walter Payton play in the Chicago area, and so it's Walter Payton for me.
Absolutely. Question number three. If you could go back in time and be in the stands for one of these historic baseball games, would it be October 3rd, 1951 National League pennant game that saw the New York Giants beat the Brooklyn Dodgers with the shot heard round the world? Or the New York Mets' improbable come-from-behind win in the 10th inning against the Boston Red Sox in Game 6 of the 1986 World Series. Which game are you going back in time to watch?
The 86 World Series. I don't know. Maybe you're reading my mind. I actually grew up as a bit of a Mets fan, and it was really just to be annoying to the other kids in school who were all big Cubs fans. And the Mets were sort of the Cubs' big rivals. in the mid-1980s. And so I grew up as a Mets fan, and I watched that on TV, and I would have loved to be there in the stands.
We have a crack research squad here at Pop Life, Abe. We know all about you. So question number four for you. If you could sit down for a conversation with one iconic, groundbreaking sports hero, would it be Muhammad Ali or Jackie Robinson?
That's tough. I think I'd prefer to be in the presence of Muhammad Ali, but I bet I'd have a better conversation with Jackie Robinson. Only because Ali's maybe, there's like too much charisma for Ali, and I'm not sure if I'd be able to penetrate the charisma into a conversation, but I feel like, and there's a lot of questions I have for Jackie Robinson that I don't have for Ali.
Well, we'll see if we can make that happen. Finally, question number five comes down to this. Abe, it is game seven of the World Series. Bottom of the ninth, tie ball game, two outs, no one on. Would you rather be on the mound or up at bat?
On the mound. On the mound. I used to throw baseballs against my garage. I dented it several times. It made my dad pretty upset, actually. But I used to throw baseballs against the garage, and that was the childhood fantasy running through my head was bottom of the ninth, bases loaded. Team up, you got to win the game. So on the mound.
Well, you have absolutely struck us out here on Pop Life. You've done a fabulous job.
Well,
thank
done.
You so much, Abe. Final question for you. What are you loving in your Pop Life? Is there something you're watching, binging, listening to? What is on your Pop Life radar these days?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a TV. I'm a bit of a sucker for TV. I watch way more TV than I should, which hopefully is not something that comes up the next time I have to go through the tenure process. But Succession is the thing that has been driving me on HBO recently. I've been watching. I love Succession. I can't wait for season four of Succession to come out. And then, of course, the other thing is we're in football season. So Thursday, Sunday, and Monday, I am glued to my TV watching football.
Well, Abe, you have been a grand slam for us here on Pop Life. Thank you so much for joining us. As a reminder to our listeners, if you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future episodes, reach out to us on social media. We are at Pop Life, WAER, on both Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for joining us for this episode, and I will see you all next time.
Thanks for listening to Pop Life, a production of WAER, Syracuse Public Media. You can find archived episodes at WAER.org, and don't forget to subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen for automatic delivery of new episodes.